Welcome to the Hardball Times Audio, your weekly stop for baseball's biggest stories, past and present, with your hosts, Jen Mac Ramos, Sarah Wexler, and Mary Craig. In this episode, we'll go over the biggest moves of the trade deadline. Jen Rubenstein of Queer Fancy Stats joins us to discuss one way fans can deal with the recent rash of bigoted tweets resurfacing. We shout out to Adam Jones for donating to Mamie Johnson Little League's travel fund. We'll examine Mike Socha's planned retirement at the end of the season, though he disputes that. We do a look at the divisional races heading into the final 2 months of the season. And as always, we wrap things up with This Week in Baseball History. So the July 31st non-waiver trade deadline has officially passed, and with it came some big deals. Chris Archer finally got traded, released from the wrath of the Rays, going from the Rays to the Pirates in exchange for Tyler Glasnow, Austin Meadows, and a player to be named later. The Mariners made some bullpen tweaks by getting Zach Duke from the Twins and Adam Warren from the Yankees. Jonathan Scope went from the Orioles to the Brewers, and Kevin Gausman went from Baltimore to Atlanta.
It happened a couple of years after people thought it might, but the Dodgers got Brian Dozier from the Twins, sending Logan Forsyth and two prospects back. And Wilson Ramos went from the Rays to the Phillies for a player to be named later. These are, of course, just some of the bigger trades that went down at the deadline. Who would we say are the deadline quote-unquote winners, and who surprised us by not doing much of anything?
Go ahead.
I'm slightly biased, but so far I'd say that the Red Sox are a major winner. Nathan Eovaldi has been absolutely sensational in his two starts for the Red Sox so far. And so if he keeps that up, that's definitely going to be one of the best acquisitions of the deadline.
I would say that the true winner of the deadline is Chris Archer, because as I mentioned, he is no longer at the hostage situation that is the Trop.
Fair point.
And he gets to go to Pittsburgh at a beautiful park.
That's true.
So the real winner here is Chris Archer. No longer has to be under the influence of the Tampa Bay Rays.
Yeah, that's like you go from probably the worst park in baseball, like pretty easily, to arguably the best ballpark in baseball. That's quite an upgrade.
Yeah.
That is. He definitely made up pretty well at the trade deadline.
Yeah.
As for teams that I think could have done more, I'll say the Oakland Athletics. They only managed to acquire Jairus Familia, and while they did need bullpen help, it sucks that they traded for him. And it just seems like there was an opportunity for them to improve their pitching staff with their starting rotation, and they didn't take the opportunity. And so while they have kind of surged, you know, anybody that wants to beat the Yankees or progress further into the playoffs than just getting the second wild card spot would need to have a stronger rotation than the A's do.
Yeah, for sure. It's also kind of weird to me that the Rockies did not do much of anything. This is a Rockies team that's obviously in it. They're, you know, not quite holding a playoff spot right now. They're like just out of the wild card. But nonetheless, they're like very much still in the divisional race and not too far out of the wild card as well. So they're in it. So that do you think that teams that are competitive are teams that are ones that want to make adjustments, and they just didn't. And maybe they just think they're set with the cast that they have. And it is one of the better Rockies pitching staffs like ever. But nonetheless, that alone doesn't, I don't know. It's weird. It's not what you expect from a team that is trying to make it happen this year.
Yeah. Thinking about like how the Rockies are in it and what kind of moves they could have been able to make, especially since like there's a lot of minor leagues who they have who are extremely good but are blocked. They have the pieces to make it happen and also try and get that postseason spot, but they just kind of stayed quiet this trade deadline, and I'm sure they have something bubbling for for that final push, but it's kind of weird to see them not just make one or two small moves. Although I wouldn't be surprised if they just do something at the on waivers. But I'd also say that I was kind of surprised that the Nationals didn't really do much of anything, because I know there were there was talk of like, oh my God, Bryce Harper is going to be available, and then they're like, no, he's not. Like, why would you? Why? Which I get, but there was a lot of rumors going back and forth about how the Nationals were either going to be sellers or buyers at the deadline, and they were kind of not much of anything. So just kind of trying to figure out what is the Nationals' plans. Are they going to try to make it for like a wild card spot, or are they just going to try to do whatever they can? So
yeah, what's weird is the Nationals made some moves, but they were moves that made them worse. Like,
yeah,
you know, they traded Brandon Kinsler, who, you know, is having a good season, 129 ERA plus. And they DFA'd John Kelly, who was also in the midst of a solid season. And the reason was because he, like, threw his glove on the mound because he was upset with his performance in a game that the Nationals were winning by, like, 20 runs or whatever. So I get, you know, maybe not being a fan of that behavior, but also that seems like kind of shooting yourself in the foot to just DFA a guy because you didn't like, you know, an action that he did in game. So yeah, that was kind of weird, because it's like, okay, if you want to be sellers and you want to like let go of some of these valuable pieces, you can like actually get something back for them. But no, you're going to like trade Kinsler for like a not especially high ranked prospect, and you're going to like just DFA Sean Kelly. That's kind of puzzling. Like, it kind of contradicts the, I don't know, Rizzo's whole thing about how, oh yeah, I believe in this team still. We have too much here to give up on. And I don't know. I mean, if it was just a matter of fixing the clubhouse, you know, apparently these two guys were the big problem, I guess. I don't know if I buy that.
So
yeah, okay. I've seen rumblings about that. I don't know exactly. Weird. Yeah, I don't know what's going on there. But it just seems like you have two guys who, by all accounts, have been really solid out of the pen, and it just seems weird to make yourself worse like that and not do anything to actively improve if you're gonna still try to go for it this year.
Yeah, I think the Nationals definitely had like the weirdest trade deadline. Between the rumors swirling about whether they would be buyers or sellers, and then them doing nothing, and then the things that they did do were done for like weird reasons. It was just bizarre, and I don't think at this point there's anybody that really knows what's going on entirely with that team.
Yeah, and at this point, like, with the way that they are acting, like, I see more and more, like, I don't think they're going to, you know, to be able to keep Bryce Harper when he becomes a free agent.
Well, easily the most controversial move of the deadline was the Astros trading for Blue Jays closer Roberto Osuna. As we've mentioned several times on this podcast, Osuna is under investigation for domestic abuse. He is scheduled to appear in court next on September 5th. After acquiring Osuna, Astros GM Jeff Lenahau released a statement about the acquisition of Osuna, stating, "We are confident that Osuna is remorseful, has willingly complied with all consequences related to his past behavior, has proactively engaged in counseling, and will fully comply with our zero-tolerance policy related to abuse of any kind. Roberto has some great examples of character in our existing clubhouse that we believe will help him as he and his family establish a fresh start and as he continues with the Houston Astros." So just how bad is this statement?
Why does it always have to be something about a fresh start? it's always like, oh, this incident happened. They just need a fresh start. And it's like, he beat up his girlfriend. Why does he need the fresh start? Like, I understand his family needing the fresh start. I don't understand Osuna needing the fresh start. It's like, you're still You still have court dates happening for a very heinous crime. I don't understand. And also, the zero tolerance policy related to abuse of any kind. So it's like, this is the part that basically frustrated me a lot, is that it's zero tolerance if you're already an Astro. Not for any transgressions prior to joining the Astros. And it's just frustrating for me, especially after the Danry Vasquez situation, where video of him surfaced beating up a girlfriend in a stairwell, and then many players, you know, once that video had surfaced to the public, many players had condemned it, including Lance McCullers, saying, you know, something like how that's bad and that, you know, that's not something that they condone. And now you have Osuna on the team, and I understand baseball is a business. I understand the Astros want to defend their title, but at what cost?
Yeah. Ironically, McCullers is the move that the Astros just made to put him on the DL to activate Osuna. Funny how life works out some ways. But yeah, Osuna just got activated. He could very well appear in a game today. Hopefully Dodger Stadium lets him hear it if he does. But yeah, this whole thing is just a mess. As many, many people have pointed out, this sort of thing can very easily be avoided if you make it so that guys who have suspensions under the DV sexual assault child abuse policy aren't eligible for the postseason. And that prevents the sort of thing from happening. It prevents teams that are competing from having the incentive to try and trade for these guys. And it keeps teams that are keeping them around, maybe makes them less likely to keep them around. It's like, okay, well, they're not going to net us anything, so we can just get rid of them because they're doing nothing but causing trouble here. And it's like, okay, so guys who have steroid abuses are popped for violations of the PED rules. They can't play in the postseason. So how hard would it be to make it a rule for this? I really don't understand. It's like, I don't know, there's a lot of cognitive dissonance going on with all that. I know that the argument people make is, oh, well, the difference is that with PEDs, that's directly related to playing the game. And with, you know, this is an off the field issue, but like, I don't care. That doesn't mean anything to me as far as punishment goes. So yeah, that's the postseason rules got to change.
Yeah. Also,
I was going to point out really quickly about suspensions, especially for PEDs. Minor leaguers get longer suspensions for quote-unquote drug of abuse if they're tested positive for marijuana, as opposed to, like, full-out PED suspensions. So
that's so goofy. Like, especially because there's states where it's legal.
Also, like, drug of abuse, it's like people also do get prescribed cannabis for medical reasons, like for helping with anxiety or whatever. Or, like, epilepsy is a big one. And it's also just, like, it's legal in a lot of states. And it's also not performance-enhancing. If anything, it does the opposite.
Yeah, it just seems like, you know, anytime an issue like this surfaces, it highlights all of the problems with Major League Baseball. You know, from the things that you guys mentioned to Justin Verlander condemning domestic violence earlier, and now that his teammates with Roberto Osuna kind to navigate his way around that by saying that he still stands by his earlier statements. But also we don't know the facts of the case, and he's just hoping that Osuna can, you know, contribute to the team. So it just seems like there are so many negative factors coming from this, and we're seeing how at the moment Major League Baseball, because of the choices it's made throughout its history, is just very ill-equipped to deal with these instances, you know, from the top to down to all of the players.
Also make the point that, you know, McCullers was very clear that in the case of Vasquez, you know, people only cared once video services, and there's plenty of instances in which there is no video. And it's just weird to me that, you know, okay, now we're going to care with Ozuna that we don't have like visual evidence that this happened. Like that's, I don't know. It just, it all seems very hypocritical, but you know, that's how people operate, I guess.
Especially in baseball.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Well, in other disappointing moments for baseball's inclusivity, several more players have had bigoted tweets surface in the past couple of weeks, namely Sean Newcomb of the Braves, Trey Turner of the Nationals, and Sonny Gray of the Yankees. What we've said about Hader applies to these players as well.
The situation has left a lot of fans feeling helpless and ignored. We're joined today by someone who has found a way to put the hurt and frustration into action. Jen Rubenstein is the founder of Queer Fancy Stats, which makes donations to LGBTQ causes based on Daniel Murphy's performance. Jen, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
So for anyone who doesn't remember, Daniel Murphy, then with the Mets, said in 2015 that he would accept a gay teammate, but he, quote, disagrees with the lifestyle 100%. He then signed with the Nats as a free agent that offseason. Which is your favorite team? Can you walk our listeners through what happened when you first found out he'd be a National, and what eventually led you to the Queer Fancy Stats project?
Absolutely. And I just want to add, so he said two things. So there was that he disagrees with the lifestyle 100%, but he also said, I disagree, talking about Billy Bean, I disagree with the fact that Billy is a homosexual. And that, I think that one's my favorite, because we hear lifestyle all the time. Like, well, you know, I disagree that you are a baseball player. That does not make you not a baseball player. So, so that all happened during spring training in 2015. And of course, in 2015, the Mets went all the way to the World Series. And it actually started then. So this all started before he ever joined the Nationals, because for that postseason, the Nationals did not make the postseason. I was actually rooting for the Mets. That's from my childhood. My dad is from Queens, so I have a little bit of a history with the Mets, and I figured that was reason enough to root for them in the playoffs in the World Series. But Murphy had pretty much single-handedly been the reason that the Mets even made it to the World Series. He got ridiculously hot, kept hitting home runs, just it was kind of out of control. So to try to figure out how to handle that within my own mind, I decided to make donations based on his performance just during that World Series. And I decided to donate to the Hetrick Martin Institute, which is in New York City. It's an LGBTQ organization behind the Harvey Milk School in New York City. So just a really great organization that I had learned about from a friend who worked there. And he then, of course, went ice cold in the World Series. I had the opportunity to go to Game 5 when the Royals won it all, which was pretty great. And I was wearing my rainbow curly W hat. So went ahead, made a donation, like rounded up a whole lot and just added some fun bonuses. And I thought that was the end of it. So now it's November and everything's over. I'd never have to worry about it ever again. So then it's Christmas Eve, and I happened to be out to dinner with a group of queer Jews when the news broke. And it's funny because no one else in the room really understood what was going on. And I started like yelling, and I was like slamming my hand on the table. I was very unhappy. And it's in 2015, the Nationals had also had one of their bat boys come out. And it started as a story that he wrote first-person perspective for OutSports, but then the Washington Post actually picked it up. There were a lot of really nice quotes that the reporter had gotten from the Washington Nationals front office. So all of those things together, I was just extremely upset. I was furious. I was pretty much ready to be done with the team altogether. But by mid-late January, I started to realize, okay, so I've been a Nats fan since the Nats existed. Daniel Murphy signs a 3-year contract, so I figure I've been a Nats fan before him. I'll be a Nats fan after him, so I just have to figure out a way to get through that time. And I was talking about it with some friends from Nats Twitter, actually, and I appreciate advanced statistics. I am not, when I say I'm not an expert, I mean, I don't actually know anything about them. So someone actually came up with the idea that I could use the weighted on base average. And if you convert the multipliers for each, everything that would factor into that. So single, double, triple, home run, walks, and stolen bases. If you were to translate the multiples, so 88 cents for a single, $1.25 for a double, et cetera, using his previous year's record, if you've translated that into cash, it would be about $25, $30 a month. And that was kind of what I was aiming for. So I figured this was something that I could do, maybe go to one or two fewer games per month and at least feel like I'm doing something that helps reconcile this, at least for myself. So got it started, was talking about it a little bit, didn't have a separate Twitter account or anything at that point, but I made a spreadsheet and I had kind of talked to a few people. And the first day of the 2016 season came, and just that one day, the total was $4.70. So immediately I start saying, oh God, what have I done? What is this going to end up being? So that whole Daniel Murphy catches fire and performs way beyond anything he's ever done before, in the playoffs, it just kind of kept going, and we had no idea that was something sustainable, and it turned out to be. He ended up making the All-Star game as a reserve that year. Then the next year, he made the All-Star game as a starter. So it just kind of kept growing. And really, after the first month, I started noticing that people were retweeting when I was tweeting about this kind of thing. I was blogging. At that point, I just kind of did a little brief recap on my own Tumblr that I rarely even used. And so within the first couple months, I ended up making an actual Twitter account and an actual blog to just keep doing that. And it's just grown since there. I didn't really think that anyone was paying much attention until I think it was either the third or fourth month that year that I actually got a phone call from one of the organizations. And when I spoke to the person on the phone, he was saying, I've talked to a few people and two of them suggested that I should call you. Just wondering if you knew why we've gotten 15 donations of $40.02 this month. So it didn't even occur to me that there were all these people that were matching. So it just kind of grew like that. So I still have absolutely no idea how many people match. I think it's absolutely incredible that other people do. I guess it's very naive of me to think that when all this was going on at the beginning, that I was the only one that felt this way. But at least at the time, that's what it felt like. So that's a point in the plus column for social media being good for bringing that together. So over the past few years, I've added donations when other good things have happened. So all of the organizations, I donate to a different organization in DC every month of the season. So it's someplace that's DC specific. But then for the All-Star game, I wanted to choose something that was more of a national organization because that was more of a national event. So I used the Trevor Project for that. Then, of course, Daniel Murphy was named to Team USA in the World Baseball Classic. So I wanted to come up with a more international organization. So for that, I donated to the International Gay Games has a scholarship fund. So I donated to that. And then there have been a few times that there have been incidents in other cities. So there were two in 2017. There was Kevin Pillar in Toronto had used a gay slur. So I donated to the YMCA Sprott House, which was Canada's first LGBTQ transitional housing program, which is located in Toronto. And then there was another incident with Matt Joyce in Oakland using a slur. And I donated to an organization called Somos Familia, which is an organization that serves primarily Latinx LGBTQ youth in Oakland. So it just kind of keeps growing, and I keep adding things when things happen. And unfortunately, things keep happening, so I keep having to add things. So that's how it started and how it's been growing.
Well, first of all, it's really great not only that you're doing this, but that so many other people have jumped on board. It's just kind of amazing, like you said, that social media can actually have power for good. And it's, yeah, this is definitely an encouraging trend. So you've already spotlighted a number of organizations that you have, you would encourage people to donate to. But do you have any advice for people who want to find worthy organizations in their own communities?
A lot of times what I've done is I've used my own social networks. That's what I did just within the past few weeks with everything that happened during the All-Star game with Josh Hader in Milwaukee. The Nationals actually traveled to Milwaukee less than a week after that. And so I wanted to donate specifically to an organization there during that series. And I really just started tweeting about it. So that's another thing social media is great for. Obviously, you can start by just doing a search, you know, Googling organizations. But I, especially for that situation, I wanted to, if possible, find an LGBTQ organization that primarily served the Black community and people of color in and around the Milwaukee area. So that's, sometimes it's a little harder to find something that specific if you're just doing Google searches. So in that particular case, social media was really great. And I think it wasn't even my initial reach. It was maybe the second or third level of people sharing that I was able to talk. I had several people that all suggested the same organization. So that's how I kind of focused in on the one that I ended up choosing, which is an organization called Diverse and Resilient in Milwaukee. And of course, the Nationals are going to host Milwaukee at the end of this month, the very end of August, beginning of September. So we're going to do that all over again. But I did the same thing for our upcoming series against Atlanta because I wanted to do something. We have 4 games in 3 days against Atlanta. So I knew that regardless of what the rotation was looking like, it was highly likely that we would be seeing Sean Newcomb since he's a starter. So I wanted to do the same thing to find an organization in Atlanta and was able to do that. But yeah, I mean, the internet is really the first place that I go if you're not already familiar with places in your area. That's a great place to start. I am more than happy to help find information on places no matter what city it's in. So my DMs on Twitter for the Queer Fancy Sats account are open. So if you ever want to talk about anything that included, let me know. I've talked to people about doing donations for things that are not directly LGBTQ related. I know there have been a lot of people in Houston that have been trying to figure out what they could do for finding a domestic violence charity. So I've talked to some people about that and different ideas of how to donate, that type of thing. So yeah, if you're not able to either utilize your own social network, I'm happy to help utilize mine or even just talk and figure out how to search that way.
So for some people, unfortunately, giving money isn't a very realistic option. For others, they might want to do more in addition to making financial donations. What else can people do to help the causes that they care about other than just making a financial donation?
Absolutely. And one of the things that I've tried to make a point to say is that it's amazing if you can match my donations, but even if you're unable to match donations of any amount, and I know all the organizations really do appreciate that. So even if we're talking about a couple dollars, $5, some organizations may be able to welcome volunteers, especially here in DC. It's a totally different organization every month. So some of them are actual brick and mortar organizations that have a staff and have volunteer staff as well. And some might not be. It might be just, you know, an organization of folks doing it from their own living room. So really reaching out to the organization to see if whatever help you'd be able to give is something that they'd be open to. I mean, maybe the organization themselves are going to be holding some kind of fundraiser and could use volunteers for that, even if it's just, you know, helping people check in at a registration table. But really, even just being open on social media and in person also, calling out bigotry from others if you're in a safe position to do so. And then if you're not out or even just not LGBTQ, sharing and amplifying the voices of people who are speaking out, I think is really big. It's amazing to have seen how far one tweet can go when it's retweeted even just a few times. That's something that I found. It's usually when I've been, you know, curious and looking for information, but just seeing it took less than an hour for me to find a great organization in Milwaukee. And I don't think I know a single person who lives in Milwaukee. So that was pretty incredible.
So speaking about people speaking up, as well as the positive power that social media can have on these types of issues, following Newcomb and Turner's uncovered tweets, both John Lester and Sean Doolittle took to Twitter to discuss the issue, with Lester first tweeting that players should, you know, delete such tweets before he started to engage with fans who wanted a more strong response from him. And then he finally, in several replies, said that he does condemn all forms of bigotry. And then Doolittle's tweet thread from the onset was very direct, asserting that bigotry has no place in baseball. So do you think that these two instances will lead to more white players speaking out about such issues? And how important is it for white players to do that?
I think it's very important and very valuable. What Sean Doolittle especially is doing, it's unfortunate that it's so extremely rare. He seems to be kind of a unicorn in Major League Baseball. And it's funny. I actually learned about him really for the first time when he was still in Oakland, when he and Aaron Dolan, who at the time was his girlfriend, were buying tickets that Oakland fans might not be using for their Pride night. And I actually already followed Aaron on Twitter before they even came to DC. So needless to say, I was very excited that day. But I feel like baseball in general doesn't have many strong voices for any cause that I guess you could deem controversial or political. So while I'd love to say, yes, we'll hear from more and more will stand up, I don't know how true that is, especially not right now. But at the same time, there were a few other Nationals players who spoke up. And I think this was particularly interesting. I feel like Sean Doolittle probably would have said something no matter what. But the fact that it was as a direct response to someone on his own team, I thought was really interesting. And especially as a fan of that team, to have it coming from both sides, that was a roller coaster of a few days for sure. But there were a few other Nats players also who spoke up, I don't think on Twitter, but at least when they were being interviewed about the whole situation for the Washington Post. I know one in particular was Adam Eaton, and I think he was a little misguided, but his heart at least was in the right place. He was using the, you know, it doesn't matter if someone is black, white, orange, purple. So I don't know any orange people or purple people, but at least he was headed in the right direction, I guess. And that's a lot better than you can say for a lot of players. But maybe I'm wrong and maybe we will see an upswing. I would really love that.
Yeah, I think we're all hoping for the same thing. And it definitely seems like there is more positive coming out of these terrible situations than, you know, a lot of people think would be the case. So that's good, at least.
You can follow Jen on Twitter at Jen Rubenstein. That's Jen with two N's. And you can follow the Queer Fancy Stats Project at Queer Fancy Stats. Jen, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
In other areas of social outreach, Adam Jones donated $8,500 to the Mamrie Johnson Little League Championship team so they would arrive in style at their next tournament in a new bus. In explanation of this donation, Jones said, "I want to see the next generation get an opportunity to succeed. Me being a black man trying to integrate more African Americans into baseball, this was a no-brainer." Jones's $8,500 contribution joins the $15,000 the team has already raised from over 250 donors. The team begins play today, Sunday the 5th, in the Little League Mid-Atlantic Regionals. If they win this tournament, they'll have a chance to play for the Little League World Series. And we just want to wish them the best of luck and note that we will be following them.
On Saturday night, Ken Rosenthal broke the news that Angels manager Mike Socha will step down at the end of the 2018 season. Socha has denied the claim, calling it, quote, poppycock.
Yes.
Socha, who has managed the Angels since 2000, is the current longest tenured manager with any one team, the second longest tenured active manager in baseball, just behind Bruce Bochy. As manager of the Angels, Socha has led his team to 5 AL West division titles and, of course, the 2002 World Series championship. As of recording, the Angels, who are expected to be competitive this year, are just 2 games below 500 and were sellers at the trade deadline. What do we make of Rosenthal's scoop and Socha's subsequent denial?
I make that Mike Socha talks like Mr. Burns. maybe he got that from his Simpsons appearance. I don't know. but yeah, if this news actually ends up being true and he does actually come out at the end of the season and be like, yeah, I am stepping down, I don't think that would be overly surprising just given the state the Angels are in. Obviously Socha's been with him for a really long time and he has a lot of history with this team, and that can be a good thing. But at the same time, if they're consistently underperforming, that may suggest that it's time for a change. And there's something to be said for letting him do it on his own terms, as opposed to letting him go. But it's weird that Rosenthal got this one wrong. Cause Rosenthal is one of the more trusted reporters in the game right now. So yeah, it's weird. I mean, I think if this were the case, it would have been surprising, but also it would have made sense. But yeah, I don't know. I think at this point, I still wouldn't be surprised if this actually did end up being Socha's last season, but I don't know. I mean, he called it poppycock and you can't get much more strong in denial than that. So we'll see.
That's true. That is definitely quite a Socha thing to say, I think. And it would be weird at this point to see somebody else managing the Angels because I think the three of us and a lot of other people have kind of grown up with Socha as the Angels and kind of thinking of the two as a pair. So it would just be very strange to see somebody else in the dugout. But at the same time, he's been there for so long and it seems like it would be a good time for the Angels to make a change and to kind of point more toward the future of the team. Not necessarily that Socha couldn't be a part of it, but it just seems like it might be certainly close to the time for the two to part.
I think that, it's possible that, maybe Rosenthal did get it right, but Socha wanted to keep it under wraps for a little bit, which I get. It's a big thing. Socha's been a huge part of the Angels for a very long time. That being said, he just decided to make this entire situation kind of socially awkward.
Jen?
No.
The opportunity was right there.
No.
Just because it's there doesn't mean right. You have to take it.
Exactly.
It was a low-hanging fruit.
Sometimes that's the worst fruit.
Not usually. Anyway. I just feel like, there are many reasons why he would be denying it, such as also, the players don't know. Maybe he wanted to talk to them one-on-one before telling the public. There's a lot of reasons. I don't think it would be unexpected if he does step down at the end of the season. I think it's just more under what terms. And also, depending on, are the Angels actually going to make it into the postseason? I personally don't think that they would, especially because Astros, Mariners, A's. But it would still be very weird to not have the Socha face memes on Twitter that I have grown up to see and begrudgingly enjoy.
Yeah, maybe he steps into a different role with the Angels. Maybe he gets some sort of advisor position or something and we'll still see him around. I know it won't be the same, but I mean, I feel like we'll still get some dose of Socha face in our lives.
Yeah. I think it's just also, it is time for a much needed change in the Angels organization. So,
Well, we've mentioned that the Angels have been underperforming. Talk some about some of the divisions. So since the trade deadline's passed and we're now in the home stretch of the season with less than 2 months until the playoffs, let's take a more in-depth look at the current standings and give our predictions for the remainder of the season. In the AL East, the Red Sox have continued to trounce the competition, leading the second-place Yankees by 8.5 games at the time of recording. In case you can't tell, Mary wrote this copy. Meanwhile, baseball's worst team, the Orioles, are 44 games back. For the AL Central, Cleveland has finally put a bit of space between them and the Twins, leading Minnesota by 9 games. And in the AL West, Houston is 5 games ahead of Oakland and 6.5 ahead of Seattle. As for the wild card, the Yankees hold the first spot, while Oakland and Seattle are duking it out for the second spot. Which division will produce the best race down the stretch, and could it be any but the NL West? Or sorry, the AL West. Well, it will be the NL West, but in the American League, what will it be?
It has to be the AL West in the American League. You know, unless something crazy happens and the Yankees win today and then sweep the remaining 6 games against the Red Sox, which I think would be unlikely. But obviously, there's a non-zero chance of that happening. However, I think we're going to have to look out west in both leagues to find the really exciting playoff races.
Yeah, I'm just looking at the standings right now, and the Orioles are actually 44.5 games back now. Way to be, Orioles. Yeah, I mean, like, in the AL East, you know, it's obviously going to be Red Sox and Yankees. In the Central, Cleveland's got a good hold on that division, but the West, like, even if the Astros do take the division, that wild card race, it's just dominated by a lot of AL West. Like, you have, you know, if the playoffs are going to be played today, it'll be Yankees, A's. But then you have the Mariners, 2.5 games back. And then, you know, after that, it's going to be Tampa, 9.5 games back. And then the Angels, 11 games back. So it's just a matter of, like, which AL West team.
Yeah.
It is a matter of which AL team. You're
yes.
right.
Do we want to go on record as picking a team for the second wild card spot right now?
Sure, we'll get it wrong. I am going to say the Mariners, just because I like their colors.
I was also going to say Mariners, but I think it's also because I have seen too many Mariners-related games.
Yeah.
You know, my heart says Mariners, my head says A's. I really would like to see the Mariners make the postseason for the first time since 2001, as I really empathize with fans for having to go through that, because that's absolutely brutal. And it would be great if they could actually, you know, kind of capitalize on the position that they've put themselves in. But at the same time, they've had some trouble of late. That's not to say they can't bounce back from it, but I just think they're going to have a hard time getting ahead of the A's. And I mean, the A's were a team that I would have felt better about if it weren't for the whole Familia thing. But that's another issue altogether in terms of what I actually think will happen. I think the A's have a better shot than the Mariners at this point. But I'd be very happy to be wrong about that.
I mean, they play each other, I think, 6 more times. So those 6 games could very well be the deciding factor.
You know what I would really like to see in the wild card race? The Yankees collapsing and both the A's and the Mariners make it in.
Oh, yes.
I think most baseball fans who aren't Yankees fans would enjoy that.
Yes. It just feels like it would be such a thrilling one game playoff, because it's like a rematch of the 2001 division with, that's, you know, both teams winning over 100 games. Like, only one will prevail into the divisional series.
Yeah, there's something very, I don't know, there's like an extra level of excitement added when you have teams that are divisional rivals competing against each other in a playoff series. It just don't know, it adds a whole extra layer of tension, and that's always fun unless it's your team that's involved, in which case it's agonizing.
Has there, since the addition of the second wild card, has there been wild card teams, I was going to say from the same division, and then I realized I was at that game last year.
Where are you going with this?
Yes, as recently as last year, we saw this happen. You saw it with your own eyes.
This is like yesterday when I realized why corn tortilla chips are gluten-free.
It's okay, Jen.
It's been a tough year for all of us. All right, looking at the National League, Philadelphia recently overcame Atlanta for the NL East lead, though Atlanta remains only 1.5 games behind. In the Central, the Cubs are 1 game ahead of Milwaukee, while in the West, Arizona is 1 game ahead of LA and 3 games ahead of Colorado. Currently, Milwaukee and Atlanta hold the 2 wildcard spots. So all of these division races are much closer than in the AL. Do we see any of these teams pulling away, or do we think that all 3 divisions will come down to the wire?
If any team pulls away, I think it'll be the Cubs. That just seems like how the Cubs operate. Like, they get really hot and then they just completely run away with the division. But that's more of a feeling than actually based in any sort of a substantive analysis, if I'm being completely honest. But I do think that these races are going to remain close. I think they're going to come down to the final days of the season and going to make for some good baseball.
Yeah, I think, you know, I agree that if anything, it would be the Cubs that won't pull away with the division, especially that, like, yes, they did get Cole Hamels, but they still don't have the strongest rotation. And the Brewers have been, you know, coming out there with a very strong offense, and would not be surprised if the Brewers manage to make a play to run away with a division. With the NL East, you know, same thing. Atlanta has, you know, been coming out strong, but I also think that one, I think the Phillies would probably end up winning that division, but Atlanta would make it a very tough race. As for NL West, that's just going to be like, all right, let's take some spaghetti that are in the colors of the D-backs, the Rockies, and the Dodgers, and see what sticks the longest.
Blue and purple spaghetti. It's appetizing.
At least the colors go well together. And it's not true.
And then, like, the Sedona red. They're pretty colors. I will give them that.
So, what teams do we think will get the wild card spot?
I think it'll be an AL... Oh my God, I can't get my division straight today. I think it will be an NL East team and an NL West team, whoever comes in second in those divisions. I don't know why I don't have faith in the Brewers, even though I picked them preseason to take a wild card spot. But
I think at this point, you know, there's just a lot of bad favor built up with them.
That's probably what it comes down to, honestly. I think that's what I think. I think whoever comes in second in those divisions, which my money is on Arizona and Atlanta. But again, I will probably be entirely wrong about this.
I am going to go far out into wherever the hell it is that's far out. I want this on the record, which it is because it's recording. August 5th, 2018, I, Jen McRamos, choose the Pittsburgh Pirates and the Colorado Rockies for the wild card spots.
All right. Yeah, I mean, the Pirates are definitely in it, which is a thing that I don't think anybody necessarily thought like a couple months ago. And, you know, it's just kind of amazing how quickly things can turn around for a team. And yeah, it would be very fun to see them sneak in there, but still got some work to do. I think looks like they're 4 games back of the second spot right now, which again, that's very much in it, but But yeah, some work to do.
Yeah, right now they're tied with the Cardinals for 4 back.
Oh, yeah. And the reason for my that pick is because last year I picked Mariners Marlins for the World Series, and that it would be a Rockies Marlins NLCS, and I was very that was the closest I'd ever had to predictions being right, with the Rockies actually making it into the postseason. So I figured, all right, let's just keep going down that path and see if I actually get anywhere close to it.
So you're just sticking with this approach.
Yes. All right. I will never log off.
Yeah, I think Pittsburgh definitely has a good chance of doing well throughout the remainder of the season, especially when they get their players back from the DL. And if Chris Archer can figure things out a little more with Pittsburgh than he had been with Tampa Bay throughout the season. But I just think that when you get this far back, you kind of build up a lot of teams that you have to leapfrog, specifically within each division. So I don't see them being better, than two other teams in their division to be able to beat them enough times to make up the difference. So how much are these standings lining up with our preseason predictions?
I will admit I do not remember my preseason predictions.
Well, we all picked the Nationals, so
yeah, that's the biggest
yeah,
difference.
That one we all kind of missed on. Other than that, I think I have the D-backs in the NL West, which I'm not 100% confident on at the moment, especially because the Rockies are in the mix, the Dodgers in the mix. The Dodgers are making a very strong case for coming back and at least, like, bringing that race down to the wire. I think I had the Brewers in the NL Central, and I think that still seems like a very possible thing. I think I had Astros, Cleveland, Red Sox in their respective divisions.
You just said the Yankees.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure we both
Yankees.
Said the Yankees.
Yeah. I was wrong about that.
Apology?
Yes, we're sorry, Mary.
Sorry, Mary.
It's had been written. But yeah, I mean, we all said those would be the winner of the East, and the second team would be the first wild card. So we got that right.
At least we had, for the most part, a general idea of who would stick and who wouldn't. Although I think the NL East is where we were the most off. I think it might have been Rhea who predicted the Phillies kind of sneaking in there into a wild card spot. And lo and behold, they're actually in first place. So that, like, credit to Rhea and credit to us for having them on here to make that prediction. Yeah. We can claim credit for it. I guess the Dodgers are not running away with it like I thought they might. I'm used to them doing. And I still think they'll end up with the division, but they're making it a lot closer than I would like. So we'll see how that all turns out.
It'll be exciting for those of us who are not NL West fans.
That's just you, Mary.
I'm speaking to our listeners.
Okay, fine, sure. I was going to say, I think one of my preseason predictions is kind of happening, which is the Giants tanking. Hooray. I love, actually, I hate my team. So there we go. I am so happy.
But what's great is they're not even like fully tanking. They're like weirdly middle of the pack and like didn't do anything at the trade deadline really. And so it's like, they're not even like, you know, like last season, like failing their way to a high draft pick. Like they're still going to be like middle of the pack. And for me, that's so much better.
There's something enjoyable about that because it's, like, you don't even get the satisfaction of, like, oh, my team sucks, but at least we get the draft pick. It's like, why aren't we doing worse? Why do we have to get some, like, pick that's, like, between 10 and 20 or, like, not top 5? And I'm just here, like, well, at least, you know, they have the whole, half the team's injured thing, and RIP Johnny Cueto's season. So I just want more chaos to come to the Giants. I just want more agony and suffering for Giants fans like myself. And I am the worst Giants fan. I think we've already gone on record for this, and I think I've become a bigger Rockies fan since we started recording this podcast last year. So
I thought you were gonna say today, and I was like, wow. Turn around.
The swift transition.
So there's my thoughts on that.
All right. Well, I think it's time for this week in baseball history. What do you two say?
Yeah.
I agree.
On August 5th, 1921, for the first time, a baseball game is broadcast with Harold Arlen calling a game between the Phillies and Pirates on radio station KDKA in Pittsburgh. The Phillies won 8-5.
August 10, 1971, the Society for American Baseball Research forms in Cooperstown.
There were some notable Hall of Fame inductions. On August 6, 1973, Roberto Clemente and Warren Spahn were both inducted. And then on August 5th, 1979, Willie Mays was inducted.
On August 10th, 1995, it's ball night at Dodger Stadium, and it turns into the first MLB forfeit in 16 years as fans threw their souvenir balls on the field three times. The game was called with one out in the bottom of the ninth, with the Dodgers down 2-1. Now, that's why if you are going to a ball game where they're giving you a ball, you don't get it till you leave the stadium. So, good work, Dodger fans. You really initiated a real change there.
We always like to see that in fans. And then on August 8th, 1997, facing the White Sox, Randy Johnson struck out 19 batters, which today remains the record for a left-handed pitcher.
Thanks once again for tuning in to another episode of the Hardball Times audio. You can find the Hardball Times at fangraphs.com/THT and on Twitter at @hardball_times. I can be found on Twitter at Jen Mac Ramos. You can find Sarah at SarahWexler32. You can find Mary at Mary M. Craig. And you can find the podcast on Twitter at THT Audio. Thanks to our theme music from bensound.com. You can find all the episodes of the Hardball Times audio on iTunes. Please rate and subscribe. Be sure to tune in next week for another episode.